Okay, so I'm going to be talking about some work done with Finn Larson in this paper here about the boundary string field theory approach to the DD bar system, and also mentioned there was a related paper that appeared by these authors. So because my talk is going to be somewhat technical, I'll begin with an outline and a summary of our results. So the goal is to understand issues related to tachyon condensation on the DD bar system using boundary string field theory, and also to develop boundary string field theory in its own right to some degree. So after saying a few words about generalities about BSFT, I'll turn to the definition of BSFT in the particular case of the DD bar system. Then I'll derive various terms in the action for the tachyon and gauge field for the system, and then show how lower dimensional D-brains arise as solitons in open string field theory in agreement with the various conjectures of Senn. The next main topic will be to derive Ramone-Ramone couplings for the DD bar system. Now, our result will take the following form. C wedge, the supertrace of the churn character of the superconnection, where the superconnection is defined in terms of the various fields appearing in the DD bar system like this. And there's also a corresponding result for the non-BPS D-brain, which I've written here. Now, using these formulas, we can verify that D-brains described as solitons in open string field theory have the correct Ramone-Ramone charge to be D-brains. And finally, this approach to computing Wessimino terms naturally leads to an index theorem of the following form, and will therefore show that the Ramone-Ramone charge arises as the index of this operator. So now let me say a few words about boundary string field theory. So boundary string field theory, or BSFT, defines open string field theory to be a theory on the space of all two-dimensional field theories which are conformal in the bulk of the world sheet but have arbitrary boundary interactions. And for the case of the superstring, the classical space-time action, there's a very simple prescription for computing it. It's simply the disk partition function. So we write down some arbitrary boundary interaction. The coupling constants lambda are identified with the space-time open string fields, and then we have various operators of the world sheet fields. And we take this action, compute the disk partition function, and then equate that to the classical action of the open string field theory. Now, you might object at this point that I haven't really defined the action because I haven't given you a prescription of what to do in the case of non-renormalizable boundary interactions, and that's correct, but here we'll sidestep that issue by only considering renormalizable interactions. Now, this approach is closely related to the sigma model approach to string theory, which has been developed by many authors, and so we can draw on the results from that literature. So the way we'll organize our calculations is as follows. So we want to compute the disk partition function. We want to integrate over all fields on the disk. And it's convenient to organize that into a series of steps. So first of all, we'll integrate over all fields in the bulk of the world sheet with fixed boundary conditions, which we'll call phi I of tau. And tau is the parameter along the boundary of the disk. Now, in general, we can consider having excited closed strings in the bulk, corresponding to bulk vertex operators. But in this talk, I'll only consider the simplest cases of the NS and RR vacua. So integrating over the bulk fields produces some wave functional boundary conditions, and we'll call that the bulk wave functional. The second step, then, is to include boundary interactions through some boundary action, and we can also think of this as specifying some wave functional, which I'll call psi boundary. Then to define the partition function, we just integrate over boundary conditions. This expression will be ultraviolet divergent, so we have to renormalize it, and we'll do that by zeta function methods. Okay, so now I will go through these steps in greater detail. So the first step is simple, deriving the bulk wave functional. So we just write down the standard NSR action for bosons and fermions in the bulk. Then we impose arbitrary boundary conditions for the bosons and fermions, which we write in terms of a mode expansion. And then we find the solution to the bulk equations of motion corresponding to these boundary conditions and evaluate the bulk action on that solution. And we write that out in terms of the mode expansions like this. And therefore, our bulk wave functional is simply e to the minus s bulk, with S bulk of this form. Okay, so that gives me the bulk wave functional. The next step then is to include the boundary interaction. Now there are a couple of basic criteria we want to satisfy in writing down a boundary interaction. So we're considering the DD bar system. Now on n DD bar pairs, there's a UN cross UN gauge theory with a tachyon transforming in the bifundamental of the gauge group. So we want, and I'll call those two gauge fields A plus and A minus. And so we want symmetry under the standard transformation rules for UN gauge fields. And similarly, we want the tachyon here to transform in the bifundamental. Now the second property we want to satisfy is world sheet supersymmetry. And we impose that by working in terms of boundary superfields. Now, if one recalls the way in which gauge fields and tachyons in the DD bar system arise from the respective Chan patent sectors, it's convenient to combine both the gauge fields and tachyons into one larger matrix, which I'll call M, with the gauge fields appearing on the diagonal and the tachyons in the off-diagonal. So our goal is to write down a boundary interaction for this matrix M satisfying these conditions. Well, there's one simple way to do that, straightforward way to do that, I suppose. We'll write down a generalized Wilson loop. So to have trace of some supersymmetric version of path ordering of the integral of this matrix M around the boundary. Now this is a perfectly satisfactory boundary action to use, but it's quite awkward. Using path ordering is computationally very awkward. So we'll adopt an alternative strategy, which is equivalent, but is more convenient for calculations, and that is to use boundary fermions. So let me explain how that works. So to use boundary fermions, we introduce some number n equal to 2 to the m minus 1 of D9 bar pairs in type 2B theory. This number is chosen to agree with the dimensionality of spinner representations. So given that, we can expand this matrix M in terms of anti-symmetrized products of gamma matrices of SO2M. Now, the idea here is to replace these gamma matrices in this expansion with fermions whose action is cooked up such that when canonically quantized, they obey a Clifford algebra. So we introduce 2M boundary fermion superfields, and we write down a supersymmetric kinetic term for these superfields, designed such that upon canonical quantization, the fermionic components eta obey the Clifford algebra. And then we'll replace the gamma matrices appearing here by these boundary superfields. Okay, so with that prescription, then our boundary interaction takes the following form. I've just rewritten the expansion of M in terms of boundary fermions and included this fermion kinetic term. Now, this is manifestly supersymmetric since it's written in terms of superfields. On the other hand, it's not manifestly gauge invariant under the full UN cross UN gauge symmetry. It's only manifest under this subgroup because we've broken things up into SO2M group theory. Nevertheless, by integrating out the etas, you can see that the full gauge symmetry is in fact there. The nice thing, though, is that there's no path ordering. This action is a scalar quantity, so we don't have to path order the action. Now, before proceeding, there's one important technical point which I want to emphasize, which is important for what we do. And that is that representing matrices in terms of boundary fermions changes the rules for matrix multiplication. So let's consider some general matrix M, and I'll expand this into blocks in this way. And I'm doing that because I'm thinking of using a basis of gamma matrices, which has this block form. So I expand this matrix M in terms of gamma matrices. Now I'll allow each submatrix here to be either bosonic or fermionic, and I'll keep track of that by assigning labels like this. Now, from what I told you in the previous transparency, to this matrix, we assign the following superfield. And what's important to note here is that we're using the convention that we're always putting the gammas to the right of the matrix M. So now let's ask what happens if we multiply two matrices together using this fermion representation, keeping in mind that we should always keep gammas to the right of the m's. So by definition, multiplying m times m prime gives this expression. Now what I have to do is I have to shuffle these gamma matrices, these fermion superfields, over to the right of m prime. And in doing that, I can pick up minus signs, depending on the number of gammas and whether if m prime is fermionic. So I can take this rule. Now, if I translate these minus signs back into matrix language, what I find is the following rule for matrix multiplication. So multiplying m times m prime, represented as follows, This is the standard rule, except I pick up various minus signs here, depending on whether these components of M prime are fermionic. Okay, so mathematically, this is important for making contact with the theory of superconnections, as will appear later. From a practical standpoint, it's important for getting the correct tachyon covariant derivative in our effective actions. Okay, so now returning back to our general action, the next step in processing it is to integrate out some auxiliary fields Fi that appear in the boundary fermion superfield. So if we do that, we arrive at the following boundary action. Now here, M1 and M0 are the two components of the superfield M. M0 squared is defined by the matrix multiplication rule I gave you on the previous transparency. Now, to illustrate what's going on here, let me write out M0 and M1 explicitly. The only point I want to draw your attention to here is that you can see that what appears in M1 is basically the abelian field strengths and the ordinary derivatives of the tachyon. What this M0 squared term does is precisely provides you with the commutator term in the field strength, as well as the correct non-abelian form for the tachyon covariant derivatives. So that's how you can understand the basic structure of this action. Okay, so this is the action we deal with. Now we turn to evaluating the partition function in a few examples. So to make the examples as simple as possible, we'll take the simplest case, which is a single D9, D9 bar pair, which in my notation corresponds to taking M equal to 1. If you write out the boundary action on the previous transparency explicitly in terms of components, it then takes this form. So here, I and J run from 1 to 2, and Ti are the two real components of the single complex tachyon. A mu is the overall gauge field of the DD bar system, and A mu Ij is the relative gauge field. Okay, so by examining this, you can see that this is an interacting theory. So we can't simply work out the partition function in closed form. So instead, we'll consider various special cases. Now, the first special case we'll consider is taking a constant tachyon, constant field strength for the overall gauge field, and vanishing field strength for the relative gauge field. This simplifies the action because the tachyons and gauge fields decouple with these choices. So the tachyon coming from this term in the partition function just gives you this overall factor of e to the minus 2 pi tt bar, where I've now defined t in this way. The remaining gauge field part depends on the gauge field. It's precisely the same dependence as arises on a BPSD brain. And we know that that calculation of the partition function leads to the Born-Infeld action. So it will do so here as well. So the entire action, space-time action, will be the tachyon potential, which I've written out here, times the Born-Infeld action. So in this potential, t equals 0 is the original D9, D9 bar pair, and the minimum, where v equals 0, is off at t equals infinity. So we expect the full tachyon potential for the DD bar system to have some sort of Mexican hat potential. And here, like in other examples in BSFT, the coordinates only seem to cover the region between the local maximum and the minimum, and not beyond that. Okay, the other case I'll consider is linear tachyon profiles, but vanishing gauge field. Now, this is a particularly interesting example because it's relevant for describing D-brains as solitons in open string field theory in the context of BSFT. So again, taking a single DD bar pair, we can use space-time and gauge rotations to bring the tachyon to this form. Now, in this case, with a linear tachyon and vanishing gauge fields, the path integral is Gaussian, so we can compute it exactly. And if we do that, we get the following partition function, which we equate to the space-time action. So here, this function f is basically the fluctuation determinants of the fermions and bosons, and zeta function regularization assigns this well-defined function to that set of determinants. Now, as explained by these authors, stationary points of the space-time action correspond to taking the y's, which I defined here, to be either 0 or infinite. Now, if you take, so we have two y's because I runs from 1 to 2. If you take both y's equal to 0, then you have t equals 0, and that's the original D9, D9 bar pair. If you take one y to be 0 and the other to be infinite, well, the other to be finite first, then you have t equals y times x1. Well, this is a linear tachyon profile that interpolates between t equals minus infinity and t equals plus infinity. In other words, it interpolates between the two vacua, between vacua of the DD bar system. So it's a kink. And according to the conjecture of Sen, this should represent a non-BPS D8 brain. So we can check that by evaluating the tension of the brain. To do that, we simply plug into our expression for the action this form, integrate over x1 and take the limit as y goes to infinity. We get this result, which identifies the non-BPS D8 brain tension like this, which is the correct value. I'm choosing here alpha prime equals to 1. Now, the other case is taking both y's to be non-zero. Then the tachyon takes this form. Well, this is a vortex configuration for the tachyon. And again, by the conjectures of Sen, this should represent a BPS D7 brain. And by precisely the same sort of calculation as here, you can check that you reproduce the correct tension for the BPS D7 brain. OK, so that's all I have to say about explicit calculations in the NS sector. Now we'll turn to the Ramone-Ramone sector. So the goal here is to turn on a constant Ramone-Ramone potential and find the coupling on the brains, which generalizes the standard Wess-Amino coupling, C-wedge, Chern character of the gauge field. So compared to what we had previously, the new feature is that we insert a Ramone-Ramone vertex operator in the center of the disk. And we choose that in the -1/2, -3/2 picture. And so the vertex operator is of this form. Now, for our purposes, what happens due to this vertex operator is that the fermions become integer moded, and you also pick up a dependence on the fermion zero mode wave functions, and that dependence on fermion zero mode wave functions is nothing but the Ramone-Ramone potentials. So what I'm calling the bulk wave functional, the result of integrating out fields in the bulk, takes the following form. So this first factor here is precisely the same function as I had in the NS case, except I've changed the moding of the fermions from half integral to integral. And now there's this explicit dependence on the fermion zero modes with the R potentials. And there are also some factors of fractional powers of I, which arise from our conventions for fermions. So our goal then is to compute the partition function using this bulk wave functional and the same boundary interaction as we had before. So we want to integrate over the bosons, fermions, and these auxiliary boundary fermions. Now, again, to simplify the calculation, let's focus on a particular Ramone-Ramone peoples one form. And we'll further take that Ramone-Ramone peoples one form to have only components in the direction 0 through p. Furthermore, we'll let all space-time fields to be independent of those directions. And we also won't allow any tensors, like the gauge field, to have indices in those directions. Well, this simplifies the calculation because the partition function then factorizes. So the first factor in direction 0 through p has the dependence on the zero-mode wave functions, as well as the piece of the quadratic bulk action. Now, the second factor, which runs over the transverse directions to the C field, contains the boundary interaction, as well as a piece of the quadratic bulk interaction. And here we have the integral over the auxiliary boundary fermions. So the first factor is easy to compute explicitly because the action is quadratic. The second factor here is the partition function of a theory with periodic boundary conditions, because we're in the Ramone-Ramone sector. Now, by standard chain of reasoning, the non-zero modes cancel by supersymmetry for such an object. Well, precisely the zero modes of x and psi cancel by supersymmetry. OK, so when computing this object, we can restrict to zero modes of x and psi. Now, if you do such a restriction, the bulk term vanishes, and the boundary interaction takes a very simple form. So the fields that appear, the quantities that appear in the boundary interaction is the matrix M. Now, if you write out two components of M, M0 and M1, restricting to zero modes, you find that M0 takes this form. Okay, now this, so we have the gauge fields again on the diagonal and T is on the off diagonal. Now, this object defines what's known as the superconnection, which is a mathematical object first introduced by Quillen in 85. Now, similarly, M1 ends up just being the exterior derivative of the superconnection. So now here in both of these formulas, I'm using a differential form notation. So for example, dt here is defined in this way. So the basis one forms I'm using are the fermion zero modes. Okay, now what actually appears in the action is this combination m1 minus m0 squared. So using these relations here, that just becomes dA minus IA wedge A, which is the curvature of the superconnection. And writing out that curvature explicitly as a matrix, it takes this form. Okay, so now we're almost done. We just have to integrate then over the fermion zero modes and over the auxiliary fermions. Integrating over the fermion zero modes just picks out the overall 10-form piece of the entire action. And integrating over the periodic eta, you can do simply by using the relation to the canonical formalism, where it's path integral is just trace of e to the minus beta h. And therefore, our result takes the following form. It's, as I stated earlier, it's C wedge supertrace of the Turing character of the superconnection. Here, supertrace is defined as trace with an insertion of sigma 3. Now, sigma 3 arises, that's negative 1 to the f for the auxiliary fermions, and it appears because we were taking eta's to be periodic. So this rather compact formula was originally conjectured by Kennedy and Wilkins. Their conjecture was based on an explicit calculation from a disk S-matrix amplitude of the lowest dt bar term in the expansion of this coupling, as well as the connection with the work of Quillen. But it's nice to see here that it arises quite simply from open string field theory. Okay, so now with that result, we can compute the Ramone-Ramone charge of the solitonic configurations that we want to identify with D-brains. So we can do this, in fact, for a general lower dimensional D-brain. So here I'll do the calculation, sketch the calculation for a codimension 2m soliton. Okay, so the way you write down a general codimension 2m soliton is through the Atiyah-Bott-Shapiro construction, in which you introduce SO2m gamma matrices, which I'll take to have the following form. And then you take a linear tachyon profile in the space-time coordinates, which is just simply some parameter u times gamma dot x. So to work out so we want to identify this object with, it says 2m transverse dimensions, so we want to identify it with a 9 minus 2m brain. And we can check that by simply putting in this tachyon profile into the Wessel-Mino coupling and the previous transparency and looking for the non-vanishing RR coupling. So that's what I've done here. I've expanded out, then I'll do integrals over the transverse dimensions, and we're left with the following coupling. So there's a coupling to C10 minus 2m, which is indeed correct for a D9 minus 2m brain, and the coefficient works out to be the correct Ramone-Ramone charge. So that verifies that the solitons have the correct Ramone-Ramone charge. Now, given that result, it's also simple to write down the result for the so-called non-BPS D brains of type 2 theory. And that's because these are defined by a negative 1 to the F left orbifold of the DD bar system, which just corresponds to taking the tachyon to be Hermitian and identifying the two gauge fields. Furthermore, there's one boundary fermion which decouples, and so one is also to omit that boundary fermion. So then doing that, you just get the same formula as before with a different prefactor and with a supercurvature here, which is appropriately restricted, and a different definition of supertrace. Or it's simple, now you can reprocess that and write that into sort of a 2x2 language, just as a simple 1x1 description, and then the action takes this form. And this, the leading term then agrees with calculations of these authors. Okay, the final topic is connection with an index theorem. So the Wessel-Mino coupling came from doing a path integral we're doing on the boundary, so it came from a path integral in supersymmetric quantum mechanics with periodic boundary conditions. And that's a well-known arena for deriving index theorems. So what we've already done, basically, is we've derived the path integral expression for the partition function. Now, that's equal to trace of minus 1 to the f of e to the minus beta h, which is in turn equal to the index of the supercharge, the number of bosonic zero eigenvalues minus the number of fermionic zero eigenvalues. So we've already computed this form, so the way to find an index theorem is to write down an operator expression for the supercharge. So to do that, we actually won't use the original action we had before, but we'll change the, we'll add in this term instead of the bulk term. We'll take the same boundary interaction as we had before, but adding this term makes this action easier to canonically quantize. So this action is invariant under these supersymmetry transformations. The supersymmetry transformation in eta is this auxiliary field F, which we integrated out previously, and F takes this value in terms once you integrate it out. Okay, so to complete the calculation, we canonically quantize this theory. Now that's simple to do. We get these commutation relations. Now we just write down an operator which generates the supersymmetry transformations, and one can verify that this operator does the trick. So it's just I psi mu p mu minus I times the superconnection. Now to write this as a differential operator, we represent the commutation relations in this form, and doing that, then the supercharge takes this form. So our index theorem then is the index of the supercharge, index of this operator, is equal to the path integral expression for the partition function. Now, before I didn't keep careful track of the normalization of the zero modes because it was absorbing that into an overall prefactor in the action. But if you keep track of those normalizations, you find this factor. And then doing that, the index theorem is as follows. So here, the index on the left-hand side, counting the number of bosonic zero eigenvalues minus the number of fermionic zero eigenvalues, well, the fermion number is defined in terms of this matrix because this is the product over all the fermions, psi and eta, using these gamma matrices. So applying this to tachyon condensation, we find that the Ramond-Ramond charge of the solitons is given by the index. And so this is one way to understand quantization of Ramond-Ramond charge with respect to tachyon condensation. Okay, since I see I'm now out of time, I think I will stop there.
Questions?
I don't feel I really understand the tachyon dependence of your potentials. The reason is that unless you go to a limit of large B field or something, the tachyon near zero momentum is very much off shell. So intuitively, it should be very hard to find topological looking formulas, exact formulas such as you're writing, that could depend on the tachyon. If you have some, for example, your final formula, which was the Ramond-Ramond charge as an index, since it was topological, it was actually independent of the tachyon. Although you get a convenient representation of the index density in writing it with the tachyon, as Quillen did. But to the extent that your formulas really depend in a non-trivial fashion on the tachyon, I don't have a technical criticism, but intuitively, it seems that you shouldn't be able to get such exact formulas unless you do something, take some limit, so that a zero momentum tachyon is very nearly on shell.
Well, there are similar, in field theory, there are calculations of the index for theories with scalar fields, in which finds a formula very similar to this.
If you're just trying to calculate an index, which is independent of t, I think your formula for the Ramond-Ramond charge was actually independent of t, but it had an index density dependent on t. And by picking a convenient t, for example, that might be a convenient way to calculate the index.
I guess I'm not sure what you mean by independent of t, since if t is zero, then it vanishes, whereas if t is the linear profile, then it doesn't vanish.
I'm thinking of a compact manifold.
Oh, okay, so it's important here that the manifold is non-compact.
Well,
I think that there are interesting cases of this formula. If the case where it's as interesting as if it's non-compact like Rn, and it's just like the winding number.
Yeah, I'm not sure. If there's really a topology in the tachyon field at infinity.
Yeah, but it doesn't only depend on that.
What's that?
And it should only depend on that.
Okay, I don't understand in your presentation whether the formulas you're getting all involve only the topology of the tachyon field, or that you're claiming to be able to get such formulas that depends on the details of tachyon.
Okay, so our formula is... Our formula is correct for the integrated value of the coupling. So it's not, there's nothing exact about it as a density. There are corrections to it. The integrated value is what we claim we calculate.
Okay. And where have you put in the fact that you're only getting the integrated value? In other words, intuitively, that's what I would have expected for the reason I said. But in your presentation,
Intuitively, I would have expected, for the reason I said, that your computation would only give the integrated values of the couplings. But technically, in terms of your presentation, why is that so?
I believe it's in the case where I restricted to only zero modes. So the to be able to throw away the non-zero modes in the calculation is only correct for the total integrated value. If I want to compute the density, I don't have an argument that the non-zero modes do not contribute to the density.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Otherwise, let's thank the speaker.